Welcome to the continuing broadcast right here on the CSJ network, where that stands for Common Sense and Justice. How do you like that?
I don't know. I like it.
This is Bob Pittman, and you're listening to Bob Pittman's Legal Line. You're either here listening live, or you're listening to the live stream of the recording, or you're listening to one of our podcasts, or as we like to call them, Bobcasts, and permanently lodged at the website, bobpittman.com, or of course go to csjnetwork.com. But my guest for this segment is Justice Gary Alexander of the Washington State Supreme Court. Welcome.
Delighted to be here.
Thank you for taking time to... Thank you. A lot of people may not realize it, but you are, in my book, a historical figure now. That's not a bad thing, but the longest-serving Chief Justice in Washington State history.
That's right.
How does it feel to be... I mean, you're in the history books here.
You know, I'm more and more feeling like a historical artifact.
Well, I don't mean artifact. I mean a really historical figure, though.
In fact, I turn 75 next month, and by law, I have to retire at the end of the year.
Yeah.
Justices of the Supreme Court have to retire at the end of the year you turn 75. I've been sort of bummed out about that because I really don't want to retire. Well, and I've been feeling, it's been making me feel old, but I feel much younger today, having seen Fred Oldfield at 93 and other people in the room at 92 and 93. I just hope that if I live that long, and I hope that I do, I can be as vigorous and as they are.
Oh, I agree. It's it gives us all hope. I mean, me sitting here at 58, working my way towards 75 and beyond. It's kind of interesting to me. I don't know, ironic or whatever. But I mean, you were a historian. You are, and you started out life in college as a historian, if I remember correctly.
Well, I went to the University of Washington, started in 1954 out of Olympia High School, and I was a history major. That was really my first love. It's not my occupation today, but it's an avocation,
yeah.
And I've maintained that interest in history with a particular emphasis on legal history because of my profession.
Right, which is really fun. And you've got, we're going to talk about some of the interesting bits and pieces from our history here in Washington, which is kind of a interesting and somewhat colorful history judicially and just our history in general and the history, of course, of our territory. And what I always find interesting is that to think back before we became a state and to realize that we did have a territorial Supreme Court at that time.
That's right.
And judges, and you, if you were a judge back then, would actually be riding horseback.
That's right. You know, a lot of people don't realize, we think of the state of Washington. We didn't become a state until 1889.
Yeah.
We were the 42nd state admitted to the Union. We were the territory of Washington for 36 years. Of the states that came into the Union after 1850, we had one of the longest tenures as a federal territory. And prior to coming, the Washington Territory being created in 1853, we were in the Oregon Territory for only a short period of time, from 1848 to 1853. And then in 1853, Congress passed what they called the Organic Act, which created the Washington Territory. Incidentally, for the people in the audience, how we acquired our name is quite interesting.
Yeah, Washington. I don't know the story.
You know, we obviously know we're the only state in the Union named for a president, the father of our country, George Washington. But when a memorial went back from the Oregon territorial legislature asking that they create a new territory north of the Columbia River, a lot of the pioneers out here wanted to call it the new territory Columbia, which made a lot of sense. The Columbia River runs between what's now Washington and Oregon. But the Congress said, no, we think that would be confused with the District of Columbia, so we're going to call you Washington, which, when you think about it, not thinking, would this be confused with Washington, D.C.?
Oh,
possibly?
Never, of course, never. Yeah,
and, you know,
never.
As you all know, when you go back east, somebody says, where are you from? You always say the state of Washington.
That's right.
If you're from Kansas, you just say, I'm from Kansas. Or
you would
from
never
Oregon.
Say the state of Kansas.
But you wouldn't say the state of, but if you're from
or
Washington.
Or the other Washington.
That's right. You have to say, I'm sometimes. From the state of Washington. And so that's how we acquired the name rather than Columbia. There were a few people in the territory that wanted to call this new territory North Oregon.
Oh, my goodness.
I think that would have been a terrible name.
Yeah, that would have been.
It would make it sound colder than it really
That's
is,
right.
you know. We think of what do we think of when we think of North Dakota? We think
Absolutely.
Freezing, you know.
Well, we think of good hockey in North Dakota.
That's right.
That's
so
what
anyway,
I think of.
But anyway, we were a territory for 36 years, from 1853 right. to 1889, and we did have a court system in the territory. We were a federal territory,
right.
and we did have a court system which had a very interesting and colorful history that they acquired during that period.
Absolutely. Now, what were the laws we were working with? I mean, obviously now we know we have the so-called Revised Code of Washington, the statutes that are passed by our legislature and signed into law by the governor and so forth. What did we actually have before statehood?
When the Organic Act created three branches of government. It created a legislative assembly,
right.
which was elected by the people in the territory. By the way, in 1853, there were only about 4,000 settlers in the territory. There were not
wow.
the number of Native Americans outnumbered the white settlers
right. by quite a few,
by
obviously.
Maybe three times.
Yeah.
But the Organic Act of 1853, passed by Congress, created a legislative assembly, which and the members of that were elected by the residents of the territory.
Sure.
But any law they passed had to be sent to Washington, D.C., and the Congress could veto any act that the legislature, the territorial legislature, passed. I don't think they did that very often, but they had the ability to do that. The other two branches of government were not elected. The judges of the territory, and there were three territorial justices, they were appointed by the President of the United States, and they served at the pleasure of the President. So every time there was an election, if a Democrat was president, they would appoint
sure.
presumably three partisans. And when a Republican was in, they would appoint someone friendly to them. And then the executive branch was also appointed. There was a territorial governor,
right.
a secretary, an attorney general, and they were appointed by the president
okay.
and also served at the pleasure of the president.
So now how long did, so typically judges or justices of the court, the Supreme Court, would last for 2, 3, 4 years,
Not
suppose.
Very long.
Not very long.
In 36 years, we had 28 members on the territorial Supreme Court,
okay.
28 persons that served, and it was a three-member court.
I was just going to say, there are only three, not like today when we have our nine.
And just think about being a territorial judge, let's say in 1853.
Yeah.
The railroad had not reached Washington
right.
yet. The only means of transportation was walking or by horseback
sure.
or by boat if you were in the Puget Sound area or on a river that was navigable. So it was a tough place to be a judge. And these three justices of the territorial Supreme Court, the territory was divided into three judicial districts. And by the way, the original territory of Washington was much larger than the state of Washington is today. The original territory of Washington included what is now the state of Washington, northern Idaho, and western Montana.
Oh, interesting.
So it was a huge area.
So a lot of...
And it was divided into three judicial districts, and each one of the judges was appointed to a particular judicial district, and they had to reside in that district. There was a judge in Walla Walla, there was one in Olympia, and one in Pierce County.
I see.
And in generally held court at Steilacoom.
Boy.
And for 11 months of the year, they were trial court judges. They would ride circuit and hear trials. And then in December, the three of them would get together in Olympia, which was the territorial capital.
Sure.
And they would serve as the Supreme Court of the territory. And they would... This seems odd. They would actually review the decisions they
cases.
Had decided as,
right.
as a trial court
judge. See, I think that's fascinating. I mean, the fact that they were trial judges for the bulk of the year. I mean, we all know what trial judges are. That's our regular old trial court level, superior court. And then to become the Supreme Court justices. So how many trial court were there only the three?
Just the three of them. They also had justices of the peace
right.
And
they would
probate
their...
judges, but they only heard the... Justice of the Peace only heard minor matters, and the probate judges heard probate matters. But so, the cases of general, what we'd call general jurisdiction, were heard by these three judges riding circuit within their judicial district and then coming to Olympia. I mean, just if you were in Walla Walla, coming to Olympia was not an easy thing to do.
Well, even driving today is, you know, takes you several hours.
Yeah. But I love Walla Walla, but it's one of those places you really don't go there unless you're intending to.
That's right.
You know, it's not on the way to anything.
I just happened to stop by and thought I'd check out Walla Walla. That's right.
Yeah.
Or it's because somebody was sent there today.
But, you know, even though those 28 persons that served as our territorial judges were political appointees,
right.
We really had some fine people that served as justices.
What do you attribute that to? Do you think it was what would you?
Well, I don't know. I'm hoping that our presidents during that period of time took the matter seriously and wanted justice to be administered fairly, efficiently, and swiftly in the territories.
Right.
The great Abraham Lincoln appointed three justices who really were, and I've read their opinions, the opinions of the Territorial Supreme Court are in three volumes
and they're actually
available, Washington Territorial Reports. And
actually available online, too.
They wrote well.
I think.
You can tell, pardon me?
I think
they're online now, too. Right. Yes, all our decisions of the Territorial Supreme Court and the Washington Supreme Court are online now. So there were some really fine judges. Judge Lander, who I may talk about in a bit, Thomas Burke. Some of you may know that name. The museum at the University of Washington is the Thomas Burke Museum. He was a judge of the Territorial Supreme Court. A man by the name, I love this name, Orange, just like the color, Orange Jacobs.
That's great.
And
a judge.
John Hoyt, who was the only person who served as a judge of the Territorial Supreme Court and also was elected to the state Supreme Court after we became a state.
Interesting.
And he was the chairperson. I really could say chairman because it was all men at the Constitutional Convention. He was the chairman of the Constitutional Convention.
Were judges at that time, the judges that were appointed, were all attorneys?
Yes.
Is that basically true?
I say yes, but becoming an attorney was not
I was going to ask you how
difficult
it was.
As it is today.
Yeah.
Very few of our early judges went to law school. You know, Abraham Lincoln's generally considered to be the greatest lawyer president we ever had. He never went to law. He didn't even go to high school.
I guess I didn't remember that.
What a person, unless they were on the East Coast and practicing in Boston or New York or someplace, most lawyers in the United States did not go to law school. They would clerk, read law, as they used to say, in a law office. And they'd be tutored by a senior lawyer, and that's how they became a member of the bar.
Now, just bringing us to present day just for a moment, we still in Washington have that very program. Yeah. I'm sure it's changed a bit.
Every year we have two or three people get admitted to the Washington State Bar by the clerking method.
Right, so they did not go to law school.
And, you know, the Supreme Court makes the court rules that govern the admission of persons to the bar, and we've had a lot of people tell us we should get rid of that rule, and I'm firm that no, we shouldn't. I think it's a great safety valve in our system.
I think so too.
To allow a person, they still have to pass the bar examination.
Absolutely,
there's a
rigorous 4-year period.
And
of
I
time.
Think if somebody wants to work in a tutorial system with another lawyer, and they want to do that, and then pass the bar, more power to them. I'm all for it.
I don't know if other
states.
There's
about two or three every year. There's a few other states, but we're one of the few.
Not much. I think we're one of the only ones.
And as long as I'm on the court, that's not going to change.
Yeah, but that's good. Although, I guess you did change the bar exam. I'm going to present day just a little bit, because when we took the bar exam many years ago,
It was three days, basically essay
the whole time.
Yeah.
And now we've adopted, I guess, this multi-state bar exam.
No, we haven't. We're the last state in the union that does not have the multi-state bar exam.
Oh, I was thinking we were about to have it.
The lawyers today take the same kind of bar exam you did.
Okay.
We have the bar studying whether we want to go to the multi-state.
Right. Okay, we'll see what happens. That was
Right now, the bar has not changed.
Very good.
Lawyers going to law school is really a creature of the 20th century. In the 19th and 18th century, most lawyers did not go to law school.
It was unusual.
If they were on the East Coast and they were going to be practicing on Wall Street or they were in Boston, they would go
to
Harvard or
something
like that, but not most people out west.
Interesting. Okay, so we have our judges who are judging regularly. Now, as a judge, they weren't practicing law, though, were they?
No, they. This was a full.
Today,
this was a full-time job.
Full-time job.
And under the state constitution, yeah. judges today cannot practice
right.
law.
Right, you have to give yeah. up, which makes sense, yeah. of course, to have to give up. The
Can I tell you practice. A really colorful yeah. story about our first judges?
We'd like to hear it.
this is a great story. This is, if this wasn't at that time so serious, it's almost comedic. Uh-huh. But what happened? Many of you in the audience have heard of our first territorial governor, Isaac Stevens.
Yes.
He was the one that made all the treaties with the Indians. And was a dynamic but very controversial person. Well, in 1856, just 3 years after we became a territory, he, on his own, decided that he was going to imprison some settlers out at Muck Creek. A lot of you know where Muck Creek is. It runs through Fort Lewis. I know that because I was stationed at Fort Lewis yeah. for a time, and I've mucked my way through Muck Creek. But anyway, these... and the only thing they did that Stevens didn't like, they were too friendly to the Indians. And that was not something that Stevens was noted to be.
Yeah.
And he thought that they were too friendly, and he was really warring on the Indians at that time. And these settlers were associated, a lot of them had been associated with the Hudson's Bay Company down in Nisqually.
Sure.
And so he had them imprisoned by the territorial militia in Steilacoom. And... But he thought, you know, there's going to be some judge that's going to want to issue a writ of habeas corpus to let these people out of jail because they haven't gone through the justice system. So to get around that, he was pretty clever. He declared martial law in Pierce County.
Oh, no.
And this was in the
just for Pierce
this
County.
Was in the district of Justice Chenoweth. And Justice Chenoweth, by all accounts, was a 300-pound man, a real large man. But at the time, he was ill. He couldn't come to court, so he called on the Chief Justice down in Olympia, Judge Lander, to come up to Steilacoom to hear this petition for writ of habeas corpus. Well, Lander comes up, presumably by horseback, I guess. Or no, I guess he could have come by water to Steilacoom. And he's met there by the territorial militia, and they hustle him back to Olympia. They won't even let him hold court. So he gets down to Olympia, and he said, well, this is my district. I'll hold court down here. So he issues a writ and of habeas corpus and has it delivered to the governor. So the governor then, Governor Stevens, now says, well, I'll make Thurston County. I'll declare martial law in Thurston County also. And he then with that, Justice Lander held the governor in contempt, issued a contempt citation. And the governor then had the Chief Justice arrested and put into custody down in Olympia. So now, we go back to Pierce County. Remember Judge Chenoweth, the 300-pound sick man? He gets out of his sick bed. He's yeah. outraged about all this.
Sure.
He goes out to Steilacoom to hold court. And just to make sure he isn't interrupted by the territorial militia, he has a sheriff's posse of 50 men to protect him
wow.
from the territorial militia, which were under the
this
control of the governor. I mean, this—I told you,
this is
stranger than fiction. You know, so with that, he's protected by the posse. The territorial militia is advised by the regular United States Army fort at Steilacoom. Colonel Casey, who was the commanding general, tells the militia, "You better back off." And with that, Governor Stevens kind of gets the word and. Calls back declared in Pierce County.
Oh, the martial law.
Martial
yep,
law.
Yep.
He rescinds the martial law, and Judge Chenoweth then orders the prisoners uh-huh. down in Olympia brought to him, including the Chief Justice, who's also
great.
in the clink. And,
so he's carted up here.
So he sends
as a prisoner.
He sends a U.S. Marshal down to Olympia, and this Colonel Shaw, who heads the territorial militia, won't allow it to be served. So Justice Chenoweth then issues a warrant for his arrest. And
wow.
with that, Governor Stevens finally gives up and says, if you just fine Colonel Shaw, we'll send the prisoners back. Colonel Shaw was fined, and the governor was fined $50 for contempt of court, which he didn't ever pay, but friends of his paid the $50
so that he wouldn't go
yeah.
to jail.
I know this sounds very comedic, but this is a true story, and it's really an important phase of our tort, because it really was an assertion by the court of the independence of the judiciary. That's the great feature of the American system is the separation of powers. The executive has certain powers, the legislature has certain powers, and the judges did. And here's a case where a governor was clearly intruding on the justice system.
Right.
And ultimately, the justice system prevailed. So
which is really
we can be proud of those old judges who had to spend a little time in the pokey there,
which probably
like Fred Oldfield did.
That's right.
In Toppenish.
That's right.
So I thought you'd like to know that story. By the way,
yes.
I'm not letting you ask me any questions.
No, this
I'm
is good. We're having a great time because there's a great book out that I want you to tell us about.
This story I've just told you is in this book along with a lot of others. This just came out. I have no financial interest in the book. I didn't write it. I am mentioned in the book because the author did talk to me. But it's called The Bitter Waters of Medicine Creek, A Tragic Clash Between White and Native American. It's written by a man in California. He's not a Washingtonian. And he is a winner of the Pulitzer Prize for another book he wrote, Simple Justice, which is a story about the famous U.S. Supreme Court case of Brown versus Board of Education.
Yeah.
And I think this is the best thing. I just finished it the other night. I think it's the best thing I've read on the territory, talking about the clash between the settlers as they came in and the Native Americans that were here.
Right.
And
In fact, we'll put a link. We'll get Jeff to put a link up next week.
And it goes into modern times, into the fish wars after the Bolt decision here more recent history. So it's a real. It's a good read. I would commend
it.
I'm referred to in the book. My pictures, actually.
That's right, pictures in there.
But
I think about people being referred to in opinions and books and things like that. Even, remember, New York Vinny was referred to in one of your famous case about the Safeco Field.
That was the case in which we upheld the funding for Safeco Field, and I put in a footnote something about what New York Vinny, sports broadcaster.
That's right.
It
who
said
now
about
I think is in Pittsburgh.
The benefits of baseball to the
that's right.
the body politic.
But let me now going back to territorial days. Did we have a jury system at that time?
They had the American system prevailed in the territory, and the jury system is a fundamental part of justice in the United States. We did have juries.
That must have been an adventure.
Chief Leshi, who's featured in this book, was tried twice by juries. The first time, it was a hung jury. By that I mean. The jury could not reach a result, and one of the jurors, one of those who voted to acquit him, was Ezra Meeker,
who
lived just a few blocks from where we are now.
Right, everybody out here.
And he
will
later
know
wrote
the
a book.
Ezra Meeker
mansion. Later wrote about it. Leshi was tried again, this time in Olympia. Interestingly, at that time, Olympia was less friendly to Native Americans than Pierce County was. I don't know the exact reasons for that, but I think. Some of it goes back to the Hudson Bay. The Hudson Bay Company was quite benevolent toward the Indians because they were really not trying to settle there. They were doing business with the Native Americans.
Sure.
Whereas when the white settlers came in, they wanted the land, understandably.
Right.
And so there were clashes necessarily occurred. But the first time he was tried in Pierce County, the jury did not convict. The second time he was tried in Olympia in Thurston County, and it was not a hung jury. He was convicted and then was hung out at Steilacoom.
Now, some people will wonder about a second trial, because usually if you have a criminal trial, that obviously was a murder trial, and there is I guess it wasn't not guilty.
He wasn't acquitted.
It was a hung jury. So that's how I was wondering how they ended up
with
the second trial.
If he'd been acquitted in Pierce County, it was a divided panel. They couldn't reach a verdict. If he'd been acquitted, he could not have been tried in Olympia. But
isn't it unusual when there was
a hung jury, the judge declares a mistrial, and you can have a new trial after a mistrial.
Now, there are times when jeopardy attaches, though, in a case.
Not on a mistrial.
That happens
frequently
all the time,
in our system today. Yeah. The jury can't reach a verdict. The prosecutor can try the case over again if they want to. Now, they may not want to.
A lot of times they don't want to.
If it was 11-1 to acquit, then the prosecutor probably isn't going to try that case over again. But if it's...
Was it unusual to go to another county, I think, at that time, or not? Probably not.
Well, it was not only unusual, it was somewhat controversial, yeah, because it looked like the territory was kind of choosing their
right
forum.
Sure.
And a little bit of forum shopping.
Right, that's right. Yeah. Now, and of course, the book, we don't want to give everything away in the book.
He talks about that.
It is talked about. And, in fact, yeah, Chief Leschi, the case was revisited by you. And
not in an official way.
Right,
we
not
held
officially
a historical court of inquiry and concluded that let me go back. In the first trial, one of his defenses was that there was a state of war existing between the territory, which was part of the United States government, and the Indian tribes, of which the Nisqually's were one of the tribes.
Right.
And the law in the United States, and I think in most countries, is that people who kill somebody in a war are not tried
right
civilly for
and that's
killing
what had happened.
And
he
in the
killed
first,
somebody
in, the first
in,
trial,
in a battle.
In the first trial here in Pierce County, the trial judge instructed that you may acquit if you conclude that there a state of war existed between the tribes and the territorial militia. But in the second trial, the judge did not give that instruction.
Oh.
And so at our historical inquiry, we had two military officers stationed at Fort Lewis testify that at that time the state of the law of war was that people are not tried if there's a state of war existing.
Right.
And we felt the historical record showed that there was a war, not a declared war
right
by Congress, but in a de facto war between the territory and the tribes because of the disenchantment by the tribes after the Medicine Creek Treaty was signed and they found out how small many of the reservations were going to be. They were dissatisfied and went to war.
And essentially, what was the Medicine Creek Treaty? What was that?
The Medicine
doing?
Creek Treaty was one of several treaties that was carried out by our first territorial governor, Isaac Stevens, to try to acquire title to the land that the Indians occupied in this area. And the first treaty was the Medicine Creek Treaty, which when you drive to Olympia, when you go down into the Nisqually by the wildlife reserve, the Medicine Creek, it's now called McAllister Creek, but it used to be called Medicine Creek. And there's a tree down there, I think it finally fell down, called the Treaty Tree.
Oh, that was actually there.
You know, if the freeway had been there at the time, you'd probably be able to see them
That's
having
right
the treaty down there, because it's right by the freeway in the Nisqually. And so it's a very interesting the book really does feature this clash between Stevens and
right
and Leschi.
Very interesting. Yeah. I picked up the book and I just started it.
Yeah.
And it looks great.
Yeah. I think any
enjoy reading
person
it
in Washington really will enjoy reading it.
I think
this
so.
Yeah.
Definitely. Now, I've got to come back to present just for a minute as we skip around through history.
Mm-hmm.
You have served now in the Supreme Court since what year? What year did you first join
I'm
the
in
court?
My 30, when I retire in December, I'll have been a judge for 38 and a half years. Of that 38 and a half, 17 will have been
17 on the Supreme
on the
Court.
Supreme Court, yeah.
And, of course, then you were in the Court of Appeals
I was
before
on the
that.
State Court of Appeals for 10 years prior to that, and then 11 years as a Superior Court judge in Thurston County.
Well, when you look back at being a Superior Court judge, what do you find the biggest difference is between that and what you're doing now as a Supreme Court justice?
The biggest difference between being a trial judge
yeah
and being an appellate court judge, because the Supreme Court is an appeals court, one of the big differences is a trial judge is pretty much on the bench all day, every day. You mount the bench at 8:30, 9, 9:30, and then you're there till 4 o'clock, and you're hearing witnesses testify, and you're
making
deciding
rulings
cases
on this. Yes.
In an appellate court, we spend more time in our chambers or our office. That's a
yep
fancy name for our office. than we do on the bench. At the Supreme Court during a term of court, we're just on the bench on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And the rest of the time, we're getting prepared, reading briefs, writing opinions, because all decisions of the Supreme Court have to be in writing,
right,
whereas a trial judge can give oral opinions.
And that essentially is done at that point and over.
And the reason that appellate opinions have to be in writing is because they're precedential. And it's as important how we say what we're doing
right
as what we're actually doing. And
right
so because that becomes part of the common law of the state. And so it's a different art form, if you will, being an appellate judge and being a trial judge. Both are great. I like being a trial judge. I like being an appellate court judge.
Yeah. But. Well, I, of course, you have the distinction, as I mentioned earlier, of being the longest-serving Chief Justice.
9 years.
And in Washington history. And I know a lot of us are kind of disappointed that you're deserting us, but it's not voluntary,
well,
I know.
I was elected Chief Justice by my colleagues three times. They're four-year terms. I couldn't finish my last four-year term because this retirement's coming up. So I thought a little over a year ago, it would be a good for the court and good for me if I voluntarily stepped down as Chief Justice and spent my last 2 years as Associate Justice.
Sure.
And Barbara Madsen, who's my successor, is doing a great job as Chief.
She is doing a great job.
She and
job.
I are close friends, and so I thought I could be of assistance to her in the transition. And
because actually none of the people on the – I'm trying to think how long everybody's been on the court. Most of them date back to where they – it's hard to remember who was Chief Justice before you, I suspect, for the operating court these days.
Dorothy's friend, Rich Guy, was my
right.
– Richard Guy was my
right.
predecessor. And he was chief for 2 years,
right.
did a great job,
yeah.
and I succeeded him.
Yeah.
And the two veteran members of our court are Chief Justice Madsen, who
right.
She's actually been on the Supreme Court 1 year longer than I have. She hasn't been a judge as long as I have, but she's been on the Supreme Court long. And then Charles Johnson from this county
right.
has actually been on the court longer than anybody on
yeah.
the Supreme Court.
Right. I remember...
he just turned 60. He's a young guy.
That's right. He'll They've both been guests on Legal Line, too. Chief Justice Madsen was running for the office of initially, and she was on with her opponent.
But the rest of them are new. We just had a new justice come on, Charles
sure.
Wiggins, who's a skilled appellate attorney.
Sure.
He hit the ground running the minute he got to the Supreme Court.
I'll bet. Yeah. But it's frustrating. I guess I look at a Superior Court judge. I could see where maybe it would get harder as one pushes out on the age continuum to do that grind, do you think, every day on the bench, do you suppose, versus an appellate court judge where while it's there's obviously work. I don't mean there's no work, but it's a different kind of work, a more deliberate. It strikes me as a much more deliberative process, which is better, I think, suited to a mind that's been around longer. I'll put it that
way.
Well,
I'll tell you, though, the great thing about being a trial court judge, superior court judge, or a district court judge that I do miss a little bit and have for the last 25 years that I've been appellate court judge is that contact with the public, witnesses sitting on the witness stand telling their story, the lawyers coming into your chambers conferences about the law.
Well, and even a jury sitting
jurors
there, of course.
Talking
yeah.
to the jurors. And we don't have that contact with the public so much as a Supreme Court justice. Our building is very open, and we love having tourists come in our building, but I don't get the stream of people coming into my chambers
right.
and into my courtroom like I did when I was a trial judge, and I've missed that over the years.
So now we may find you actually sitting in
as a retired
a
judge,
judge or a district court
retired
judge.
Retired judge, I can pro tem on any court in the state that will have me, so I may go back and be a trial judge. One of my former law clerks is a district court judge in Thurston County, Sam Meyer, who's a wonderful young guy, fairly new judge. And as you know, the small claims court is in the
that's the people's court, I call it.
You know, where they're arguing over $300
yes.
or something like this, you know. And I told him.
With
I
said, great emotion.
I said,
great,
I would love to come up and do their small claims court.
Yeah.
You know? And
I think it'd be great.
If they're arguing about they bought a toaster at the store and it doesn't
that's right.
work or something like this,
that's
you know.
Right.
And that's real Cracker Barrel justice, but I'd love.
But that's
that.
Real life, and it's
and
it means a lot to the,
and
to
those
the litigants.
Those cases, I'm not. Disparaging amount. Those
no.
cases mean a lot to those
no.
people, and it's important. Neither in a small claims matter, neither side can have an attorney, and it's real raw justice,
it
but
is.
Important justice.
You know, sitting here at the Fred Oldfield Center, it kind of takes me back to cowboy justice almost.
Right.
You know, territorial justice, small claims court might be the closest thing.
Yeah.
I wonder. That we've got to, it'll be interesting. So if anybody is looking to contest their red light speeding ticket or something down the road, or a small claims court, right, you want to watch for the court where Justice Alexander may show up one day and be your
I think
judge.
I did a little.
I think that'll be great.
You know, we even once in a while, a traffic case will make its way to the Supreme Court if it's got an important legal issue there that needs to be decided. And factually, those cases are tough, you know.
Yeah.
Somebody comes in and saying, well, I was, they said he was speeding, and the guy said, no, I looked at my speedometer. I wasn't speeding, you know, and how do you, I wasn't there. I didn't, you know, you have to just judge it the best you can, you know.
What's one of your most memorable cases on the Supreme Court, would you say? That's probably a tough one, I'll bet.
Yeah. You know, people ask me that all the time, and it's just
And we should tell people you can, you know, you can talk about the cases that have been decided pretty freely, I believe. But, of course, anything that's coming up before the court or likely to come before the court.
I'll tell you the case that got the most interest of any case that, and I, judging by the number of people that attended, the amount of mail that we receive, you know, judges, we're not supposed to receive ex parte communications.
And tell everybody what ex parte means.
Ex parte, I mean a one-sided communication. Somebody, we're not supposed to get mail and say, gee, well, I hope you rule for Joe. Or, you know, and if we see something like that, we have to put it aside. I don't have anybody open my mail, but I can tell pretty quick if I'm getting lobbied about a case that's coming. But
when the Starbucks card falls out of the envelope here.
The biggest case we had in terms of public interest was the so-called gay marriage case. The background on that is our legislature passed a statute quite a number of years ago that marriage is between a man and a woman.
Right.
And there was a suit brought in two suits, one in Thurston County and one in King County, by individuals claiming that was unconstitutional to limit marriage to between a man and a woman. And the two trial judges ruled in their favor, and then the matter came to us on appeal. And we had, the briefs were very extensive, and the day of the trial, our courtroom only holds about 100 and some people. We can put in extra chairs and maybe, I don't know if you've been to the Temple of Justice in Olympia.
Courtroom.
The court, it's a beautiful building, and it was built, the court's been there since 1913, and the courtroom is really gorgeous.
I mean,
I've been on the court for a long time. I still get a thrill every day I go in there. But the we can get about 150 people in with extra chairs. We also have a television. All of our hearings are televised on public television. And so we have a television set out in the foyer. We put chairs out there. The courtroom, the foyer were full. There was a church across the street, the United Church Olympia, that had television. People could go over there and watch it. They had television sets in the Capitol building, the legislative building. People were over there. I mean, we had hundreds and hundreds of people, and we heard the case. And as you may know, we decided by a 5-4 vote. It was, the court was closely split. That 5-4 upheld Washington's law, which says marriage is between a man and a woman. Now, we weren't saying that's what we would do if we were a legislator. We're just saying that law is not unconstitutional. If the legislature wants to change it, that's their, or the people, by initiative, they can do that. But we upheld the law. But I just mentioned that case because I think there was, and then afterward, the mail we got, I mean, and it was about 50-50, you know. Some of them were, you dumb idiots, you know.
Yeah, well, most of it.
Or, you know, or a great decision.
Obviously and very emotional.
And we really can't, we have to put that stuff aside.
Sure. It must be hard sometimes knowing that you are the court of last resort. I mean, unless someone can somehow make a federal issue out of something.
We're the last. The Washington Supreme Court is the last word on any state law question.
Right, which is,
if there's a federal law question in the case, which there often is, then they can seek review by the United States Supreme Court. But it's rare. In that, in the 17 years I've been at the court, I would say the U.S. Supreme Court has taken about probably less than 15.
Yeah, not very many cases
from us. Now, if they take one, they're probably going to reverse you. Because it's been my observation, they don't take cases from a state Supreme Court to affirm
just
you.
Just to agree and say, yeah, play that.
And that makes sense, because there's something in that decision that they probably saw that they didn't like, and that's why they granted review.
How many cases does the Washington State Supreme Court take a year, roughly?
We issue about 135 opinions a year. And that may not sound like a lot, but it really is. That means we have to have read briefs, have oral argument, issue a decision, and we have to issue a decision. There's 365 days a year, so about every 2.5 days, if you take out the weekends, we have to issue an opinion that's been signed by 9 people, and either in the majority or the dissent. And sometimes these opinions will run, 75, 80 pages.
Sure.
And so it keeps us hopping. Compare our work with the U.S. Supreme Court. They're a 9-person court. They only issue about 80 opinions a year.
Right.
So we almost double their workloads, which I'm proud of that fact.
I think that's good. How many cases?
Let me tell you another. Case that comes to mind.
All right.
You remember the Gregoire Rossi election
went
down to the wire.
Right.
We had 2 cases come to us about what ballots should be counted. You know, in King County, they kept finding ballots on the floor there in the auditor's office.
I think I had a few in my trunk one time.
So we had two cases about what ballots could be counted, and we had to get those out quick because people had to know on January whatever day the swearing-in was to take place, who our governor was.
Yeah,
I'm really proud of the court. We were unanimous. In one of them, we ruled on Rossi's favor, and the other one, we ruled on Gregoire's favor.
Uh-huh.
We didn't set out to do it that way. That's just the way it turned out. And on one of them, we issued the opinion, the written opinion. I was the author. The next day after argument, signed by all the court. And on the other one, we issued it the same day. So I was really proud of the court on that, that we...
Wow.
People may not have liked our decision,
no, but
we did it quickly, you know. And,
but part of having justice, I think, is having something in a good time frame. Obviously, it's not really
justice
if it drags on
forever.
Well, that's one.
We just couldn't take months on that. We had to get that out.
Right.
There are other cases where it may be 90 days before we get the opinion out.
Now, when you're actually, let's say you're going to write an opinion, how is it decided initially that you're going to be the author of an opinion?
Well, when the cases are set for oral argument, one judge is pre-assigned by lot. It's not; it's just randomly selected. One judge is assigned the responsibility to be what we call the reporting judge. So after oral argument, that judge will speak first and will make a recommendation to the court. They've issued a memoranda a few days before that, which gives a written recommendation. But they can change their mind, but ordinarily they don't. And then if that judge ends up in the majority, that judge will get the writing assignment.
Oh, okay.
If they don't end up in the majority, they can write the dissent, and then the Chief Justice has to assign somebody else to write the majority.
So when you're actually going to write the opinion, are you writing it? You have like a law clerk? Or
each justice has 2 law clerks.
Okay, and they're helping, I assume,
some
extent.
They're new lawyers out of law school.
Right.
We get the cream of the crop, and they help us do research and they can help in the drafting as well.
Interesting, But it must be a lot of work to just get that opinion together.
That's the hardest part of the job.
Yeah.
Writing is tough.
I mean, the rest of us are out there just reading them, me as a lawyer, just looking at them, and it always looks pretty darn good, I have to. I mean, it's good, the formatting, everything.
You know better than I. Talking is easy. Writing is hard.
That's right, Dorothy... Dorothy Wilhelm does her column, and that's hard. That's hard work, I think, doing her column.
If you take pride in your writing, it's really...
That's right.
I think, Dorothy, I don't know if you agree with me, but the editing is the most important. Get it down and then keep working it over.
Yeah.
And try to make it shorter if you can. Somebody famous once said, if I'd had more time, I would have written you a shorter letter. And if you think about that... It's easy to write a lot, but it's harder to boil it down to its essence.
So what's the quality of the work coming in, the briefs that are coming into the court? Is it all over the map?
Well, let me tell you this. They call them briefs, but they're not briefs.
They're not brief at all. Briefs, again, are these written...
That's the lawyer's written argument.
Right.
And then they make an oral argument in which they'll hit their high points of their brief.
So all of you are reading those briefs, though.
All of us have read the briefs before the oral argument.
And never falling asleep reading them, right?
No, that's right. And then that's why you'll see us ask the attorneys a lot of questions, because we really don't want to just get a canned presentation. We've read their argument.
Sure.
We want them to answer the concerns that we have.
Right. If you go back now to the territorial days with all these cases that were done in the before statehood, 36 years, I guess, was it very similar? I mean, were there written briefs submitted to the court then, which literally were written, handwritten?
We have them there at the Temple of Justice. You can look at the
And they
old
were
briefs.
Handwritten. Am I correct? I
yes.
mean, I don't know how... typewriters back in the
Later, before we had the word processors and everything, you used to have to go to have your briefs printed by a printer.
Interesting.
And you'd go down, you'd have your secretary type it on a regular standard typewriter, and then take it down to the quick print or somebody like that, and then they would set it up and print
it. But back in the territorial days, were they actually going?
I think in the early part of the territorial days, they were in longhand,
right?
And then later they were printed. I don't know. I can't remember.
Interesting.
When did the typewriter come out?
I'm not even sure. Yep. Dorothy's going to help us. She was actually there when the typewriter. No, that's not true.
Well, I was.
Fred might have actually carried the first typewriter by horseback.
No,
Fred Oldfield.
Mark Twain typed the first novel. That was when the typewriter came in. So it would have been. And do you know what it was?
No.
Which one of his novels?
Yeah.
Huckleberry Finn?
Good guess.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So that was when it came in. I probably threw it.
He also was very involved. My dad was a printer, so I remember the old linotype machines.
Yes.
Where there was like a typewriter, and it would make lead lines of what was being typed. And Mark Twain was also, as I recall, very involved in the early development of the early linotype machines.
But we can know when the typewriter came in by the fact that that was.
Yeah.
Anyway, I did not mean to intrude on your show, but this is Dorothy Wilhelm.
Thank you. Thank you. We are at the Fred Oldfield Western Art and Heritage Center. Broadcasting in our own special way live, and this will, of course, be carried on the live stream this coming Wednesday, the 23rd of March, will be broadcast out across the Internet. It's amazing to me. You go across the around the world, theoretically, on the Internet, and then it will become a podcast, or some of us call them Bobcasts, of course, and so they'll become a podcast that will be available anytime to listeners or people who are here and they want to hear again. That'll be great too. But
I'm really I make a lot of public appearances and have all through my judicial career, but I'm really delighted to be here today. I was raised in Olympia, so I've been to the. I always used to love to come to the Puyallup Fair, but I'd never been to this Western Heritage Center.
This is great, isn't it?
And this is terrific. And I'm looking forward afterward to walk around and check things
it really
out.
Is.
And I love the artwork on the wall.
Yeah.
You know, I said early on I wanted to be a historian. Yeah. Before that, I wanted to be a cowboy.
Oh, really?
I mean, I was raised on, I'm sure people in the audience, Roy Rogers, Gene Autry, John Wayne.
Sure.
And I can't even ride a horse, but
John Wayne, have you seen the new version of True Grit?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
It's supposed to be very good.
I've seen both, and they're both very good independently, but of course, it's hard to beat John Wayne.
I hardly ever pass up a Western, but except for Clint Eastwood and Kevin Costner and a few other people, they just don't make many Westerns
anymore. It's a little, maybe they'll make a comeback.
Yeah.
But Fred Oldfield is just a real treasure, and the art that we have, some of the art I see, I see a lot of tags where people have allowed the art to come back, and it's actually in their collections. And then there are several that, of course, are just his collection, his personal collection. And I noticed there's some new ones that he's just done recently out front that are even available. But it's just
I love that one. You mentioned this one.
Yeah.
In the snow.
Isn't that great?
They're returning home.
Yeah. It looks almost 3D when I look at it, I guess.
And just the light in the cabin window, I think that's really great.
Yeah, it really is. So, but I want to say thanks to you, Justice Alexander, for taking time to be out here. I think it's pretty neat, by the way, in general, that Supreme Court justices will ride circuit, if you will, get out and into the public. I mean, I really do, because I think sometimes people tend to think of judges as just being there in the courthouse. And yes, you have a very serious job to do. I don't mean to make light of it, but you're a real person, and the other justices I know are good about getting out as well. I don't know our newest justice; I haven't seen out yet.
Yeah, I think all the members of our court are good about that. Yeah. I think they enjoy it, but there's also another motive. It is an elected position,
well,
so it probably doesn't hurt to get out.
Which a lot of us like. Now, I guess I can ask you now. You're not going to be voted on again, but I mean, I've been a proponent of electing judges ever since I can remember, and I don't know how do you feel about our process?
I'm a strong proponent of it. I will never run again. I'm too old to run again.
Well,
but I think that it's electing judges. Not every state elects their judges. Most do, no. But not every state. The federal judges are appointed for life. But I think electing judges is consistent with Washington's culture. We like our public officials, whether they're in the judicial branch, legislative branch, or executive branch, to be accountable to the public by periodic elections. And I think, don't we in Washington, we elect everybody.
Yeah, I think we do. I don't think there's
anybody. And I don't think that's a bad thing.
I think it's a very good thing.
Accountability is important. And it also, for judges, it keeps you that contact with the public. And not that it influences how you decide cases specifically, but I think it is important to know that when we're hearing a case, we're not talking about X and Y. We're talking about real people with real problems. And it makes you want to be careful to do the right thing.
Now, we're going to ask you to come back on a future program to talk about the Washington State Constitution a bit, because we have some. Yeah. I mean, if we were to do a teaser into another segment, I know our right to bear arms in Washington is very special and very different, if you will, than the U.S. Constitution, for example.
It's the language is broader. Although with this recent decision out of the United States Supreme Court, they did say for the first time that it's a personal right, not just a right to be a member of a militia. And so I think the U.S. Supreme Court in that recent decision, which I think was a 5-4 decision or maybe 6-3, they've broadened, I think, the interpretation of the Second Amendment. So,
but also our right, we have a very strong right to privacy. Yeah. In our Constitution,
our right to privacy is more protective than is the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
So we'll be picking on you down the road a little bit for a segment on that, because I think it's very important that we all learn, and we look to our Bill of Rights on the federal level and our state constitution for really our everyday life. So I want to say thank you very much for showing up.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And appearing on this. Thank you. And we'll be looking forward to other segments and red light camera judging coming. No, I should say I don't appear before the Washington Supreme Court, so I can take some liberties, but not too many. Thank you very much.